Welcome to Thriving in Business and Life. This is Will Wilkinson.
And this is Christopher Harding. And last week, Will, we started out our round again by talking about a thriving mindset.
Right.
And just kind of clearing up sometimes the misconceptions that people have when they hear us use the term a thriving mindset or being in a thriving state of mind or being. And made it clear that we're not suggesting that your life has to totally be working perfectly in order for you to be considered being in a thriving mindset.
Well, no, I think nature is a great example. I love that picture. I think we have it in our course of a tree growing out of a rock face.
Right.
So, you know, nature is full of examples where adversity is handled because of the thriving energy. It lives in nature that's natural. And what we're saying is when we have a thriving mindset, we'll find ourselves able to handle what shows up in our lives.
Exactly. And that sometimes the circumstances could be challenging, but how we get through those circumstances is very different if we're tapped into more of a thriving mindset than one of merely surviving the situation.
I keep remembering your friend. You've mentioned him often, the guy who loved chaos.
Right, right.
He'd rub his hands together. What are the challenges going to be today? Now, that's a thriving mindset.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he chose to be, let's put it this way, to be lit up by the challenges of difficulty.
Yeah, so, you know, sometimes with a skill or a state, the question arises, are you born with it or can you learn it? In this case, I think it's both, but we're really focusing on how you can learn to have more of a consistent thriving mindset.
Exactly. Part of what we talked about last week, too, was that just the recognition that we're always making up stories about things. We're creating stories in our mind about what this situation means and what it means about me and you and others. And for us to be aware that since we're making up stories about the situation, part of what we can train ourselves to do is make up stories that tend to lead to a more positive outcome.
Right. I remember Mark Twain saying, I'm an old man, and my life has been filled with many tragedies, most of which have never happened. I think that's a great way of describing what you just said. We tell these stories. We worry about things. They don't happen that way.
Well, my friend Mike Green called that marching down the parade of imaginary horribles.
Yeah, you know? Imaginary horribles. So if we have the capacity to imagine horribles, we can just as easily imagine wonderfuls.
Well, and so let's get down to earth, too, because I can hear some people going, yeah, that's easy to say when your life is going along normally or okay. But, you know, we were talking about my friend Rick Jones. The thing that maybe I've never shared about him was that he had one arm that was almost like a little kid's arm.
Mm. That was from birth?
From polio when he was young. And so this was something that he'd been ridiculed from the time he was young.
Mm.
It had been inconvenient, to say the least.
Right.
And, you know, he could have allowed that to become just an anvil, so to speak, around his mm-hmm. positivity. Mm. But instead, he chose to see it another way.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a funny story, but he called me one day and said, well, I did something interesting over the weekend. And I said, really, what was that? And he said, well, I gave my arm a funeral. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, it was just a bother, so I had it amputated, but it had been with me my whole life, so I figured it deserved a burial. And he, you know, it was the story he chose to tell about what could have been, I'm sure, wasn't easy experience, but it's how he chose to frame it. Now, there are tragic, horrific things that happen to us in our lives at times, and we're not negating that. It's mm-hmm. it's not like we're saying put some Pollyanna code on the fact mm-hmm. that something horrible happened. But it's, as my friends shared with me after I went through a traumatic earthquake experience and died and was revived, they said, you didn't get to choose, perhaps, that this earthquake happened. You weren't in control of that.
Mm-hmm.
But what can you do now mm-hmm. to get your life back? So how do I want to frame the story going forward? And so that's what we mean.
Yeah, and I think the clarification that's been made by stress experts is that circumstances on their own aren't necessarily stressful. It's our reaction to them. because things happen. For one person, it might be stressful. For another person, it's thrilling. It's exciting. For instance, for me, going on a roller coaster is very stressful. The fact that people pay to do that is amazing to me. My stomach just can't handle that. So that's stressful for me. But that's a reaction. It's a story I'm telling, which I've told for many, many years. And maybe a day comes when I go on a roller coaster again and decide to tell a different story about it.
Well, and as when we say tell story, what we mean, of course, is that it's what's the story I gin up in my mind, and how do I infuse that into my interactions? How do I live it out, in other words?
Yeah, and I want to go back to something you just mentioned a moment ago, because I think it is a valid concern that sometimes when we have this conversation, people can be concerned that we're downplaying the significance of circumstance. Not at all. There are many individuals who are dealing with horrific circumstances. And our concept of a thriving mindset not only doesn't denigrate that and say it's not important, it says this is really important to pay attention to and learn how to thrive in the midst of that kind of adversity. Often people will prepare for a crisis when times are normal. So by all means, we can learn how to thrive before the really serious crises occur. That way, we're ready when they do show up. If they suddenly show up, we may be called to step up big time. But the principle remains the same. Am I thriving or not?
Yeah, and we've used the example of Viktor Frankl on Man's Search for Meaning. You know, in the midst of being in a Holocaust, surviving that experience in a prison camp, he chose remarkably to decide how could he make everybody's day around him better.
Yeah.
And that's the approach he took on. That was the story he began to tell in those horrific circumstances.
Well, I'm remembering interviewing a woman in Virginia who lost her husband and 13-year-old daughter in the Mumbai terrorist attack of 2008.
Yeah,
wow. Her family members were over visiting, and they were going from ashram to ashram on a meditation retreat. And then they returned to their hotel, and the terrorists came in and started shooting. And unfortunately, her husband and daughter were both shot and killed. When I interviewed Kia about this, it was clear that this was the worst thing that ever had ever happened in her life. And it devastated her. And she described where she was walking in the woods and fell to the ground and just felt herself disappearing into the earth, sobbing, weeping uncontrollably. And I cried when she told me that. It was so moving. But she didn't stay in that forest forever. She got up and she's founded the One Life Alliance, an international nonprofit. She now lives part-time in India, part-time in Washington, D.C., and she teaches forgiveness to school children in England and throughout America. So she's one of my heroes because she encountered this horrible tragedy and she really felt it. She didn't just have some kind of superficial band-aid over it. She let it devastate her. However, she then climbed out of it and has gone on, as she's doing now, writing books, doing addresses, helping school children. That's what I think of when I think of thriving, someone who's been able to do that.
Wow. Yeah, what a remarkable story.
Yeah.
You know, as you're saying that, it reminds me as well that we often say we don't recommend trying to do this on your own.
Yeah.
We always suggest having at least one or two or more people in our lives who we call them our thriving buddies or accountability partners, so that when we find ourselves starting to act out a story that's not in our best interest, we at least have somebody close by who can, you know, offer us an alternative script that we might want to adopt.
Yeah, both you and I are very fortunate because we have wives who do this for us.
Exactly, exactly. And it's family members too. I mean, I've just got wonderful family members who will challenge me when sometimes the story I'm living out is utterly delusional.
Yeah.
And you know, they'll bring me back to home and help me realize what are some of the real circumstances.
Well, this actually illuminates another dimension of friendship. Often friends are thought of as people you can hang out with, that you can relax with. And, you know, while that's true, I think this other dimension to friendship is friends who hold you accountable to be your best.
Yeah.
And will help show you your shadow. And we can't always see our own shadows. I had this experience on Sunday. I have a group that I meet with, a group of men that I've known for 30 years, and we get on the phone with each other once every 2 weeks and have an hour, and conversations are always amazing. And so I brought up something that I really felt I needed help with, because I knew I was in a story, and that there were parts of it I couldn't see. So it only took me 5 or 10 minutes or so to, you know, present my story about this particularly challenging circumstance I have in my life right now. And one by one, these men from Italy, from England, from New Zealand, gave me really great comments. They weren't giving me advice. They were just reflecting on the story that I was telling. And I found it immensely beneficial. And I remember getting off the phone and just sitting there for a moment thinking, wow, I am so grateful to have friends like this who I can count on, really in a way, not to let me get away with anything. They hold me to the highest standard, and that's what I call real friendship.
Well, and your willingness to allow them to do so. You know, a lot of times it's easy for us to try to retain our own persona or the identity we've created for ourselves. I know when I've had some hard truth-telling sessions with friends or family, you know, where they've been telling me things, it's gut-wrenching at times to realize, you know, that what we've been acting out, the story we've been enacting, has not been landing for them the same way we thought it was.
And I often say that the meaning of communication in what's received, it's not in what's given. You know, we have an intention and we communicate, but what does the person receive?
Yeah, they call that the difference between intention and impact, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and it is disturbing, I want to agree with you here, to find out that our impact has been less than 100% positive. And that is really a challenge, because all of us think of ourselves as being nice people, great people, and we mean well. It's kind of like nobody thinks they're a bad driver. We know there are bad drivers. I've asked this in workshops. I said, how many of you are bad drivers? There'll be 200 people there, and not a single hand goes up. And I'll say, well, we know there are bad drivers, right? Isn't it amazing there's no bad drivers in this room? It's kind of a self-delusion that we all think very well of ourselves, and nothing wrong with that, but we also need to be honest that we're all works in progress, and our friends, our family members can help us keep growing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, as we talk about stories and you know, the need for that partnership, the friends and family and so on, who will help us really hold ourselves accountable to be living a truly thriving story for not only ourselves but others. One of the things that can kind of sneak into the equation and really blind us is something often called unconscious bias.
Right.
You know, it's when you think of the word bias, I mean, it's kind of like it's by its very nature. I mean, it's almost like if you looked at it as a geometry equation, it's a slice. It's a part of something. I'm not seeing the whole picture. I'm only seeing one narrow perspective.
Well, it's like that cartoon of the elephant and the blind men, five blind men, each touching a different part of the elephant. One touches the trunk and he says, "Oh, it's a snake." Another one touches a leg and he says, "Oh, this is obviously a tree." And they each have their own perception of what the elephant is, which is flawed because they're only getting a slice.
Right. And so the question is, that was, by the way, my mother's example that she shared with us regularly when we got ourselves hung up on a particular perspective or bias. It's remarkable because biases typically are unconscious. We don't realize we're looking at something in such a skewed way. And, you know, where they tend to show up, where they can be particularly harmful is when they turn into what are commonly called stereotypes, where we lump a whole group of people into one narrow little category and act as if they were all the same way. And then the question is, how does that impact how we make decisions, how we interact with people, who we choose, who we don't choose? Because what's happening, if you think about it, and this is why some of our clients call unconscious bias the virus of bias, is because it sneaks into our thinking and infects our decision making and our whole thought process the way a computer virus does.
Well, and I have one that I've just identified and pretty much gotten over recently. I realized that I had a bias relative to overweight people.
Hmm.
And I've always been fairly slim myself. And I didn't realize, I was unconscious, it was an unconscious bias as you're describing it, that I just assumed that anybody who was, you know, seriously overweight was irresponsible. Mm. They were lazy, they obviously weren't eating the right food, they weren't exercising. And actually it was my wife who helped me become conscious of this and said, you know, that's a judgment. And you can't really be sure that those are the reasons that person's body is the way they are. There are hormonal issues, genetic issues. She said, I know a lot of people who are overweight who do everything they can. They barely eat, they exercise, etc., and they still can't lose that weight. There are other things involved. So this was a bias of mine that had degenerated into what you were just mentioning, stereotyping, and I found that I was discounting overweight people and just lumping them all together and assuming that they didn't have as much value as someone who is thinner. Well, it was quite embarrassing to realize.
Well, and wonderful of you to acknowledge, because I think we all have our own version of that in some way. This is interesting, because I both grew up with a mother who had challenges with her weight and was always wrestling with it. So I knew firsthand some of the things that your wife was sharing about some people's metabolism and hormonal balance and all kinds of other things. But the other thing I learned as I got into really grief groups around sexual assault survivors and so on, is that a lot of times the issues that sometimes people have with maintaining what we might call a healthier weight balance had to do with really armoring themselves after a history of horrific abuse or assault. So we don't know people's stories. We don't know the behind it. And yet, the example you gave is such a perfect example, because we attribute to people that we put into the category of a stereotype or an unconscious bias all of these less than characteristics.
Right.
And like you said, it's profound. We unconsciously discount people's opinions or their value.
Yeah, I mean, we know the phrase, don't judge a book by its cover. But that's exactly what we do with other people when we have a bias going. I'm a writer, and I often use the example of books that, you know, a book sitting on the bookshelf where you can only see the spine really has no value. I mean, maybe the title's interesting, but it's a whole different world when you take that book off the shelf, you open it up, and you begin to read what's inside. And people are like that. You know, we meet someone for the first time, well, there's the spine of the book. We see what they look like, we learn their name, perhaps we learn what they do, a little bit about them. But unless we're interested to read their book of life, we're not going to really know them. And so I think a lot of people feel someone else's disinterest to really get to know them, because they've categorized them. We don't need to even say anything. It's just a feeling that gets conveyed. And in the workplace, you know, this is very important, because a lot of people don't feel seen. And they won't speak up, and they won't contribute the way they'd like to, because nobody seems interested in them.
Right, right. And as you know, we deal with helping organizations deal with all kinds of differences around diversity and inclusion. That's one of our areas of specialty. And so it becomes really important for us to help leaders and the everyday employee start to recognize and just question themselves. Do I have a bias that's crept into my thinking?
Right.
Is there some social stigma or bias or limited way of thinking that's keeping
me from seeing? And the answer is going to be yes. I mean, often it's going to be yes, because I mentioned weight, small issue, age, appearance, gender, nationality, on and on it goes. Intelligence level.
You know, it's interesting with weight, since we're on that one. It is one of the considered by some sociologists as being what is still an acceptable form of discrimination.
Today?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. That because there's no law against
true.
It. It's not
true.
A protected class.
Yeah. Right.
And it's curious, because like I said, I grew up watching my mother struggle through this. I grew up around friends. One of his close friends had some tremendous challenges with their weight that was really impacting her health. and, you know, close friends that I love dearly, and yet I can always still remember the social meme creeping into my consciousness. It was kind of this thing where I was consciously having to push it away because the stereotype and the social meme was so strong. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of this odd conflict that I was fighting. And so you're right, we are always, all you got to do is watch TV, look at a newspaper, hear the radio, listen to people on the street. I mean, we are constantly being bombarded with the opportunity to adopt limiting stories, yeah, i.e. biases,
exactly,
about ourselves or others.
Well, I'm remembering my brother telling me something fascinating years ago. He's a filmmaker in Canada, and he was turning 55 or so, and his hair was getting gray, and he was dying it. And he said to me, look, he said, if I didn't color my hair, nobody would take me seriously down there in Hollywood.
Right.
Because he was working with a lot of younger people, and they just think he was an old guy and not pay attention to him. Now, I think that attitude has changed a lot. But years ago, he felt it was necessary to look younger than he really was to be accepted. And, I mean, look at what women go through to, I mean, you look at films where an actress is 60 and she looks 30. There's been some work done. This bias against aging, against wrinkles, etc., we need to be perpetually young, that's a real burden for people who are in the public eye and are identified a certain way, but time does its thing and they can't show up the same way. What do they do?
Well, and here's one that's kind of funny. I mean, having spent a lot of time, as you know, as well in LA in that industry, there's a lot of men who've had work done too.
Yeah, right.
but your point is that there's a bias against age in a variety of sectors, mm-hmm, and that, you know, whether it be that I'm dyeing my hair or altering my physical features or whatever it might be, there's a phenomenon actually called stereotype covering. Mm. In other words, I'm pretending to be who I'm not, mm-hmm, because if I allow myself to be who I actually am, people will not see me in as good a light. Mm. And so talk about stories, right? So if my story about me is I'm not okay being myself, I've got to pretend to be somebody else. Now, we can probably all relate to that in some very real ways. I mean, I know I've pretended to be people who I'm not to fit in. And it's such a self-betrayal. Mm-hmm. So we talk about a thriving state of mind. That's not a thriving state of mind, but I have visited it many times over the course of my life.
Well, who hasn't? And you're reminding me of the fraud complex.
Right.
Pretty much everybody feels fraudulent in certain circumstances. They feel that they're representing themselves in a fraudulent way. They're not really who they hope others will perceive them to be. And there's all kinds of strategies we come up with to inflate ourselves or change ourselves to fit in, because we want peer acceptance, we want respect, we want love, all that's natural. And unfortunately in our society, especially as we're growing up as children, there's not a lot of education around self-acceptance, particularly relative to our uniqueness. There's certain norms like IQ, you have to hit a certain level, athletics, and if we don't hit those levels, it's very easy to feel inadequate, and then we begin to inflate or change, and as a result, we end up feeling fraudulent.
Well, yeah, and again, all of those, and this is the point we were making last time, each one of those situations is based on stories, mm-hmm, that have been made up, and a lot of times those are societal stories. So in other words, it's a story that's become accepted by a large group of people. Yeah. And in order for us to fit in with a story where we don't fit, we've either got to create some kind of unique identity for ourselves. So the real question is just, first of all, for us to be aware that we are making up stories. Yeah. We're applying meaning to what happens, imposing meaning on situations, imposing meaning on happenings. And that the meaning we impose has very often been infiltrated or infected, as we sometimes say, by some of these social memes or stereotypes or biases. If we can just start asking ourselves the question, what story am I telling right now? And has it possibly been infected with a social bias?
The real aha here is asking those questions and challenging our habit of identifying with the roles we're playing. We all play many roles during the day. We could be a father, a plumber, a teacher, a dishwasher. In any moment, we're playing different roles. But none of those roles are who we are. We are the one playing those roles. I'm remembering Buckminster Fuller wrote a book called I Believe I Am a Verb. And I feel that's a great description of the thriving mindset, that I am alive. I'm this unique character who, like an actor in different movies, plays different roles. I am not any of those roles. I'm playing those roles. So when we recommend that people develop the thriving mindset, become conscious of their stories, etc., it's not to figure this all out and arrive at some great role that we can play for the rest of our lives. We're going to continue to play many of them, but it's to change our identity and actually embrace this thriving mindset so we can, you know, flow ourselves into whatever we're doing, really enjoy it, do a good job, and feel unlimited.
Yeah, you know, in one of our next programs, we're going to be talking about values and how the values we identify for ourselves can help really shape our stories, shape how we, you know, you could say, ward off or become aware mm-hmm. of unconscious biases, but also how it can help give us direction. Mm-hmm. And so as you're talking about that whole notion of how do I see myself? Have I over-identified with a particular role? I know for a lot of people that role might be provider. Yeah. Whatever that role is, are we allowing it to limit how we show up? Yeah. And so that the opportunity this week is just examine your roles, examine your stories, ask yourself the question about biases, see what it reveals, and start to play with it and see if we can get a little bit more fluid with how we decide to act out a certain scenario.
Yeah, and let's just emphasize that there's nothing wrong with those roles. I mean,
No.
We should embrace them. I mean, imagine an actor who didn't really feel great about the role he was playing. You know, he wouldn't be very effective. We love it when an actor can get into his role and, you know, he is that new person. I mean, I'm not going to be the same way on the dance floor as I am when I'm doing my accounting at the end of the month.
Right.
Those are two different roles. If I showed up on the dance floor with my wife in an accountant mindset, nothing wrong with accounting here, I wouldn't be as good a dancer.
Right. So it's being able to adapt and shift and be more fluid in terms of how we act out our roles and how we see ourselves.
Yeah, and the real key to this is that when we identify that way, as Buckminster Fuller said, as a verb, we have this thriving mindset, then we can relate to other people in the same way. They're doing what we're doing. They have roles, we have roles, we're all telling stories, but we meet other people on a very different kind of level. It's, oh, here's another storyteller. They happen to be in a body that looks very different than mine. It's younger, it's older than mine, it's different color skin. They have different skills, they speak a different language. Well, we now understand this doesn't make their otherness threatening or less than or more than. It's just the role they're playing, and we can be peers, we can be equals on the thriving level.
I love it. That's a great way to close up today. So if you've got stories about your own stories or realizations you've had, please write to us at thrivinginbusinessandlife@gmail.com. I'm Christopher Harding.
And I'm Will Wilkinson. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you again next week.